as a translation group, whenever we get together, you know, we bathe it with prayer, we worship together. And that, to be honest, is another criterion for being invited on, is somebody we know that's not only a good scholar, but a person who we know loves God, is involved in their church.
On In Good Faith, we believe that all faith traditions have something to teach us about how God is working in the world and in our lives. So join us as we listen and learn and discover how speaking with people of other faiths can strengthen our own faith and even our own practice. I think it's fascinating that most people in the world today get their scriptures secondhand. That sounds sort of weird, but Muslims all across the world have the Quran given in its original, as dictated form in Arabic, but most of the believers speak other languages. They'll still refer to that, but they have a colloquial translation. And the same with the Bible. Most of us don't have this head full of Hebrew and Greek and Aramaic. So Heather Bigley, producer of In Good Faith, you love translations.
Yes, well, I've had the opportunity briefly to work as a translator. It's really hard work. Your brain is on fire the whole time. But I also love the Bible. And as you said, Steve, I don't know what the original texts say. So how close can I get to that original text? And so I'm fascinated by those people who serve as our intermediaries.
So we are kicking off with this episode, a few episodes about translation and different kinds of ways of understanding the original intent. So you jumped right in and talked to someone who does this.
Yeah. So we're going to talk today with Trimper Longman. He is a senior translator for the New Living Translation. He's written over 35 books, including Confronting Old Testament Controversies. And he's also a distinguished scholar and professor emeritus of biblical studies at Westmont College.
I love your question that you start off with, which is asking him, are you doing word for word or ideas?
It's colloquially known as thought for thought. In other words, we're trying to engender the same thought in the mind of the modern reader that was evoked in the ancient reader. You can only do that so well, but languages don't typically line up word for word. So a word for word translation, those are helpful too, but they're not as readable. And actually, I would argue that thought for thought translation, which is also called functional translation, is more accurate, you know, in that it helps the reader really get to the meaning of the original text.
I was looking at an interview that you did with, I think, Apollos Water last year, and you guys had an interesting discussion about the language of the King James sounds incredibly formal to our ears, but if you go back to the original texts, this is not in formal, highfalutin Hebrew. Can you talk to us more about that?
Actually, in terms of the Old Testament and the New Testament, there's a variety of different styles. Most of it is pretty ordinary Hebrew, not highfalutin style, high style Hebrew. And the same is true for Greek, but there are exceptions like Isaiah. And in the New Testament, I think Hebrews is an example. But I would also make the point that the King James Version was thought for thought in the 17th century. You know, it's like, this is the way people talked back then with thous and thees and so forth.
Yeah. I think one thing that's helpful, if you can master thou and thee, is that it does show you what's a singular you and what's a plural you.
Oh, yeah.
How do you guys handle that in the translation that you're in charge of?
Well, I mean, that distinction does get blurred in modern English. Context will often help a person realize. I was just working on Psalm 77 today because it's 20 years since it came out and English language changes enough and we get some new insights into the Hebrew and Greek text. So we're engaged in a major review, and Psalm 77 has a series of questions that are kind of accusatory toward God. Have you rejected forever? But we translate it, have you rejected me forever? Because the psalmist had just been talking about how he's lost sleep, and so he's kind of personalizing it. But one of my colleagues said, well, actually, the psalmist here is representative of the community, so maybe we're individualizing it too much. Mm. So the you, people would automatically kind of understand in this context as singular you, but he's suggesting that maybe we translate in a way that shows that it's a community. I rejected his advice, but I have to on that point, because I do think it's an individual thing. What's really important for our faith, essential to our faith, is clear, you know, so you're not going to lose track of the big points. But there are a lot of things that are debated in terms of translation. Translation is a form of interpretation. We make thousands of interpretive decisions while we're translating. A really good example is Genesis 1, 1 and 2. Whether you translate the Hebrew, "In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, period. Now the earth was formless and void," like the NIV and the NLT and the ESV and most evangelical translations translate it. Or like the NRSV translates something like, "In the beginning, when God created the heavens and the earth, comma, the earth was formless and void." And so the Hebrew is ambiguous to us, and you can justify either translation. But what you don't lose is the fact that God created everything.
I actually went and looked up one of my favorite verses in Revelation, which is 21:3-4, because I wanted to see what the difference was just from the King James to the New Living Translation. And the major difference I saw was actually incredibly helpful for me. In the New Living Translation, I heard a loud shout from the throne saying, "Look, God's home is now," I'm sorry, I'm going to cry. "God's home is now among his people." And in the King James, it says "God's tabernacle," which I think if you're not that familiar with Jewish history and the Hebrew Bible, that tabernacle word can really throw you off. But that use of the word "home" just spoke to my heart, you know?
Yeah. And both of them are correct. It's just that what the NLT makes clear is that the tabernacle is God's home on earth. And we often forget that the tabernacle in the wilderness was this elaborate tent where God made his appearance palpable to the people who were themselves dwelling in tents.
Yeah, beautiful. Okay, so talk to us a little about you. How did you become a translator? Like, when I look at your education, you went to Ohio Wesleyan, and then you decided to do an MDiv, and then somewhere along the way you said, actually.
Yeah.
So what was that journey for you?
Well, thanks for asking. So I didn't become a Christian until the summer before college. I mean, I grew up in the church, but I didn't make any religious demands on me, to be honest. And so we're going back to the late 60s. I graduated from high school in 1970. So I became a Christian, and then I went off to college and I said, "Hey, I'm interested in the Bible, so I'll take some religion classes at Ohio Wesleyan University," which sounds religious, but it's a secular university. This was during the day of the Jesus Revolution. My hair was down to here, and I was a hippie for Jesus.
Yeah.
But my professors started raising a lot of questions about the Bible, about my faith, and that challenged me to think more deeply for my own self. And so when I went to seminary right after college, I was hoping that God would lead me into an academic position. Because the other thing younger people like yourself, Heather, don't realize is that in the early 70s, in terms of Bible translations, you really had the choice of either the King James Bible, the Revised Standard Version, which was rejected by more conservative Christians for various reasons, and also the Living Bible, which was a paraphrase. There wasn't an NIV, there wasn't a New Living Bible, there weren't a lot of accessible Bible commentaries or anything like that. So I wanted to be somebody who could contribute to that. But I wasn't really sure whether I'd go into New Testament, Old Testament, maybe church history. But then I had a really great, charismatic young Old Testament professor. And I realized that the people who were going into academics ahead of me in the seminary were all going into New Testament. So I thought, if I want a job, maybe I should go into Old Testament. But I was really attracted to the Old Testament. I like studying ancient cultures. And so my PhD at Yale is actually specialization in ancient Mesopotamia and its relationship to the Bible. So I not only studied Hebrew, I studied Akkadian, which was the language of the Babylonians and Assyrians, Ugaritic, which was the language of the Canaanites, Aramaic, and a little bit of Arabic, and then also the culture and the literatures of these various people. I had already published a few books, commentaries based on the Hebrew text. So when they put together the team to do the New Living Translation around 1990, Tyndale House Publishers kindly contacted me and asked me if I'd want to participate and be in charge of the Psalms and Wisdom books. And there were six of us, and I was the youngest by 10 years. Two of my dearly beloved colleagues have died, and then the three others are in their early 80s. So we've all taken on younger understudies. And so that's been a lot of fun.
Well, that's interesting. Earlier, you talked about how all translation is interpretation. I've also heard all translation is commentary.
I would not agree. I would ask the person, what do you mean by commentary? Because commentary is, when I write a commentary, I'm explaining why I'm translating and what it means. So I'm not doing commentary, but I am interpreting. It's basically, it's interpretation without the commentary. Then we usually, you know, there's a New Living Study Bible, which I participated in, and there we give commentary and suggestions why we do it, or translated it the way we did. So basically, the younger scholars that I work with know this, what is important for them, and we actually would vet a person before we'd invite them to be a formal part of the translation, that they're both comfortable with as well as able to do a translation according to the translation philosophy of the New Living Translation. And we work as a team, you know, so I'll do an initial translation. When we did the original translation, I'd then send it to three other experts in the field who would then respond to my translation. I'd consider their changes. And if two of them disagreed with me, I was bound by oath to go with their translation, which I was happy to do. And then we send it off to stylists. And then it comes to the Bible Translation Committee, of which I'm a member. And I'll lead a discussion, say, on the Psalms and questions that come up. And it's that group, which is made up of six general reviewers, including myself, and about three or four stylists that will make the final decisions.
I was reading that this actually, the original translation took 10 years and 90 scholars. And then hearing you describe the way you work together, what is the feeling in the room? I mean,
well, that's a great question. And I'll get to that. Yeah, there were 90 people involved. There were six of us as general reviewers. Each of the six of us had five different sections. And for each of those, I invite three different scholars to work with me. So here's why it was good and is good, is because it was very intentional to put together that original group of six and then the group of 90, based first of all on their expertise in translation. But then secondly, we had to know that they were good people to work with, that they were team players, and that they weren't narcissistic, opinionated. And it's, you know, we're here 34 or 35 years later, and everybody loves each other.
I mean, I'm assuming when you're translating, and maybe I'm wrong, but I'm assuming that there are times when you want the Spirit to confirm what you're doing.
Oh, yeah.
And how do you bring the Spirit into the room?
Yeah.
If there's, I feel like you can debate, you can assert your opinion, but if people are disrespectful to each other, how do you then get that confirmation?
You know, over the past 30 some years, I don't really remember any egregious case of disrespect, but you're so right about the importance of the Spirit as a translation group. Whenever we get together, you know, we bathe it with prayer, we worship together. And that, to be honest, is another criterion for being invited on, is somebody we know that's not only a good scholar, but a person who we know loves God, is involved in their church. That's extremely important. Now, on the other hand, at least my theology doesn't mean that calling on the Spirit leads us to some kind of inerrant translation.
Right.
And so you got to be careful about that too. There's this interesting mythological story about the Septuagint translation, which is the first translation of the Old Testament into another language, and it was Greek in the second century BC. It's called the Septuagint because according to legend, there were 70 translators, which they sent to 70 different locations. And when they all came back together, they had the exact same translation. And anybody who's worked on translation knows that's a myth. So again, you know, I would say that you can use any translation of the Bible, King James, New King James, ESV, et cetera, et cetera. And none of them, even though there are differences that we could point to, none of them are going to mislead you in some kind of substantial way about God.
Well, let's get into that. I think the average lay person actually who feels like they've done their Bible study might in fact be a little dismissive about different translations.
Yeah.
And I see that you're actually involved with as a consultant on other translations.
Yeah,
so
right.
Talk to me about why use different translations. You know, in my own tradition, people actually are a little concerned. They don't want to use the wrong thing. You know, so in church, we'll hear the King James, and I think a lot of people still study the King James,
right.
Even though, you know, when you're reading Paul, you might feel like, what in the world is
being said? Yeah, I know, right.
But I think there is this caution, like, I don't want to go astray. So why use different translations? What do they bring to your own personal life? What are they good for? Why should we not freak out when someone says, oh yeah, there's a new translation coming out?
Well, because there's no inerrant translation. And by the way, as a footnote, probably one of the biggest buyers of the New Living Translation are people who use the King James Version as their primary translation. They'll read it, then they'll go, wait, then they'll read it, oh, now I get it. And, it's, and so none of these translations are inerrant. I mean, at least the typical doctrine of biblical authority is that no translation is inerrant. It's the original manuscripts, which we don't even have. So, but we also believe strongly that what we do have is very accurate, but not perfect to the original manuscripts. So I think there's nothing to be afraid of to use other translations and to compare them. And when there's maybe something that you see is different in one than another, then get a good commentary or study Bible and see if that can help you understand what's going on there. Because there are some difficult texts that we deal with.
Yeah, so it makes sense. Personally, for years, like when I discovered the NIV, I was like, oh, gosh.
Yeah.
And the study Bible aspect, right?
Some translations preserve more ambiguity because they want to not suggest interpretation. So let's just take an example, not of an actual text, but you'll run across the phrase in the Old Testament and the New Testament, Hebrew and Greek, the word of the Lord, right?
Yeah.
So it says the word of the Lord. Now, the word of the Lord can be a word that the Lord speaks, or it can be a word about the Lord, you know? So it's a word of the Lord. It's a word that's talking about the Lord. So context will often help us decide which one of those two, and a more what they call formal equivalent or word-for-word translation like the ESV will preserve the ambiguity and they'll just say word of the Lord. Whereas the NLT, if we're convinced it means a word about the Lord, we'll translate it the word about the Lord. And it's good to have both these kind of translations out there.
Yeah.
And so they're basically different things. When I talked earlier about translation philosophy, another factor has to do with what we talked about too, high style versus more accessible, ordinary English language. Matter of fact, when we're doing the NLT, sometimes we'll translate something and then we'll ask ourselves, will the Walmart shopper understand this? So we do try to avoid a lot of technical religious language, like say atonement. We'll say, rather than atone, we'll say something like make right with the Lord. We have translations that use the term atone as well. They're a little bit more precise, but both are accurate. And then there's the theological consideration. So one's theology affects, you know, your interpretation. Now, of course, our theology is derived from the Bible, but then there's this interesting spiral between reading the Bible and understanding your theology. So that's why Bible translations are typically done by scholars within a broad theological spectrum. So the NLT and the NIV are broadly evangelical Protestant translations, whereas the ESV is more narrowly Reformed Protestants. So you have to be in the Presbyterian or Reformed Baptist tradition in order to be a translator. The NRSV is more mainline Protestant, and then, of course, you have Catholic translations and so forth. So yeah. In the King James Version would be a British 17th century Protestant translation.
Yeah, handed to the poets afterwards from what
exactly.
I understand.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and we actually hand it to the stylists, English professors who help us try to bring some style to the translation.
As a former literature teacher, the King James Version and Shakespeare, two most important influences on English language literature for at least
absolutely.
400 years.
Absolutely.
So anything you can do to sort of spark that imagination in the reader, I think, is welcome.
Absolutely. So. But the same thing's true in German. You know, Luther's translation really had a big impact on German language and so forth. So
yeah, I bet. There was a time when I lived in France and I would take a French Bible with me to church. And it was interesting. The language is ancient.
Yes. Yeah.
And as a little American, I was like, I think I understand. I mean, I've heard these stories before, I'm not completely certain that I'm getting everything here. So, Yeah. Anything we can do to help people access and feel closer to the sacred theologies.
Hi, this is Stephen Cap Perry, and I'd love to recommend one of our BYU Radio family of podcasts for you. It's called The Appleseed. It's filled with stories for you and your family. Every episode features really excellent, nationally known storytellers sharing all kinds of folk tales, fairy tales, personal and family stories. It's great to put on and listen to for road trips or bedtime for kids or anytime you want something to get the whole family not only listening, but then those stories generate conversations. And it's so easy to say, hey, do you have a story about this? Or, oh, that reminds me of when grandma said, or whatever it might be. Check out the Appleseed podcast. You'll have fun and you might learn some new stories from your own family members. This is In Good Faith with biblical translator Tremper Longman.
You mentioned that you became a Christian before college. I mean, if you don't mind sharing, what was that experience for you?
Yeah, well, it was a wonderful experience. You know, I grew up in a loving family, but we went to this more liberal church and they didn't really call on us. They just assumed we were all Christians, so I didn't think anything of it. But I played football in high school, and I will just brag momentarily that we were first in the state of Ohio and third in the nation among high school. So we were a powerhouse. But a young Baptist minister moved into the area, just started working out with us, and we didn't think it was all that strange. He was pretty athletic himself, but he was obviously coming so he could share the gospel with us.
Yeah.
And a bunch of us became Christians through his witness to Christ.
I first started going to church because I called a friend for the homework. I was in middle school, and her dad said, oh, she's at the church playing basketball.
Oh, yeah.
And I was like, oh, I would like to be invited to your church, you know?
Yeah.
That kind of outreach, I think we're all looking to belong and we're all looking for support in some ways. And sometimes we come at it maybe from the side, but it yields good fruit.
Yeah, ultimately. Amen to that. So, and then I went off to college and we had a more informal Bible study fellowship. And interestingly, a lot of those people went on to become pastors or missionaries, or in the case of my best friend from eighth grade, a guy named Dan Allender, he is a prominent Christian psychologist, and we've written about 5 books together on various topics, combining our Bible and counseling interests. So it is interesting to see how God used that little informal fellowship. Well, it wasn't so little. Actually, it grew to like 300 students. And I'm still in touch with a number of them.
That's really beautiful.
Yeah.
So that was a long time ago. It was a long time ago for me. What do you know now about God that you didn't know?
Well, I mean, I think my faith was real, authentic, and very naive back in the day. And speaking of which, my friend Dan Allender, the psychologist, and I, we've written, as I said, 5 books, but we thought about writing a book based on a common line that was used in evangelism back in the 60s called, "Accept Jesus and you'll have the abundant life starting right now." And so we were thinking about writing a book saying, "The abundant life, we should have read the fine print." In other words, yeah, it's an abundant life, but it's not devoid of trouble, suffering, loss, difficulties. And there's no promise anywhere in the Bible that says that Christians aren't going to suffer. Matter of fact, just the opposite. It says our joy will be in spite of our suffering. Jesus can give us a peaceful heart in the midst of difficult times. So yeah, that's one area in which I think I've grown a lot, that just seeing God is good in spite of the trouble. And I'm an expert in the Psalms, supposedly, and so we have a lot of lament Psalms, right? So a lot of crying out that God invites our laments. And then we also have these Psalms of confidence, like Psalm 23, where we're suffering, but we've come to the point where we can trust God in the midst of the suffering. The laments are, "God, why are you doing this to me?" And then the Psalms of confidence are, "Even though I walk through the darkest valley, I will fear no evil." Psalm 131, "I've calmed and quieted my soul like a weaned child with its mother." But it takes a while to get there. In the midst of intense suffering, kind of like Job, you know, Job laments to God and argues with his friends. But at the end, he has an experience of God that leads him to trust God, no longer accuse him of injustice. And Job doesn't know he's going to get restored at the end, but he's still willing to stop his accusations against God and just trust him in spite of not ever hearing an answer to his question of, "Why is this happening to me?"
Well, and even though he is arguing and feels embattled and is upset with God, God still comes and gives him this experience, right?
Right, exactly.
I think that's such an important thing for me to remember, that God's big enough to handle.
Exactly. That's a good way of putting it.
Whatever pain that I have.
And right.
Instead of turning away from God and saying, "Well, he doesn't want to hear me complain."
Right, right.
Job teaches me, maybe he doesn't want to hear you complain, but even if you do complain, if you're reaching for him,
right,
he's going to reach back to you.
Contrast the lament Psalms with the grumbling in the wilderness. The Israelites grumble in the wilderness, and God doesn't like this. And he, you know, opens up the earth under them, sends fire on them. But he invites laments. And the difference is, with the laments, you're going to God and complaining to God about God. Whereas in the wilderness, they're complaining about God to each other. They're not bringing their complaints to God. So it's really important to observe that distinction.
Many thanks to Tremper Longman for speaking with Heather Bigley. This episode was produced by James Sturtevant. Our production team also includes Aaliyah Alexander and Heidi Hansen. Our post-production sound designers are Mark Hansen, Lauren Sandberg, and DJ Cromarty. In Good Faith is committed to the idea that we all benefit from hearing people of widely varying backgrounds share their personal experience with faith and belief. In fact, we think people with such experience deserve some of our best listening. Find us on Instagram and Facebook at In Good Faith Podcast. Also, subscribe to our YouTube channel for extended interviews. In Good Faith is a production of BYU Radio. I'm Stephen Cap Perry. I hope you'll join me again soon right here in Good Faith.